ABC Radio National.
After PM, it's Media Land, your weekly wrap of media movements with me, Tim Burrows.
And me, Danny Saeed, filling in for Vivian Kelly.
Triple M and Marty Sheargold quickly parted ways over on-air jokes about the Matildas. Are Aussie radio standards changing, or is it still all just business?
And a look inside political DIRCE units and how they use the media for mudslinging.
That's in half an hour on ABC Radio National. Catch you then.
ABC News with David Rollins. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has reportedly arrived in the United States ahead of talks with President Donald Trump. Sarah Amir has the latest.
Flight information suggests that the Ukrainian leader has landed in the US as he works to iron out the details regarding a critical minerals deal with Washington. The US wants access to Kyiv's rare earth minerals to help American taxpayers get their money back for aid sent to Ukraine throughout Russia's invasion. Key details surrounding the deal are yet to be announced, but Volodymyr Zelensky has said that no American security guarantees have been agreed on so far. The US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has said that the relevant agreement has already been completed and will be signed by both sides on Friday local time.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has sought to shut down concerns about the US President's commitment to the AUKUS pact. Donald Trump today appeared to not know the meaning of AUKUS when asked whether it would be discussed with his visiting UK counterpart. Anthony Albanese says the President has made his commitment clear.
There's a lot of acronyms in this business. And, we all get thrown at them from time to time. I've seen President Trump's comments. He went on to speak about the really important and positive relationship with Australia.
The future of casino operator Star Entertainment remains in doubt following a plunge in the company's share price. Business reporter David Taylor has the details.
Star Entertainment requested its shares be suspended from trading shortly before the open of trade this morning. It did this as it was unable to provide financial documents requested by the Australian Securities Exchange, or ASX. A short time later, it updated the ASX to say the board was exploring liquidity options or the possibility of a much-needed injection of cash for the business. Star's share price dropped sharply when trade resumed later in the day. It's unclear if Star Entertainment has secured a financial lifeline. The firm's financial documents need to be produced today.
Lawyers for the ABC have finished giving their closing remarks in the unlawful termination case brought by Antoinette Latouf. Ms. Latouf took legal action against the broadcaster after she was taken off air during a radio presenting stint in 2023. Ian Neil SC, acting for the ABC, has told the judge that Ms. Latouf breached a direction given to her not to post on social media while employed. He also argued a part of the psychological harm she experienced was caused by her own activity on social media. The Weather Bureau has warned that Tropical Cyclone Alfred will cause hazardous conditions along Queensland's coast this weekend. Stephanie Felicina has the story.
Tropical Cyclone Alfred currently sits 720 kilometres east-northeast of Mackay as it tracks slowly south through the Coral Sea. The Weather Bureau says it's increasingly confident that the Category 3 system will stay offshore, but it's still uncertain how close it'll come to the mainland next week. Senior forecaster Baden Gilbert says there'll be some impact to Queensland's southern coast.
We are expecting to see abnormally high tides and damaging surf occurring through this weekend across much of the southern Queensland coast, from the southern Capricornia to the New South Wales border.
The SES has mobilised teams from Mackay to Bundaberg.
The New South Wales coroner has ordered police to investigate the death of a toddler at a Sydney hospital. 2-year-old Joe Massa was brought to the emergency room at Northern Beaches Hospital last year. His parents say he had a dangerously high heartbeat and had to wait more than 2.5 hours for a bed, but did not survive. Police have now retrospectively reported his death to the coroner, marking the first step towards a potential inquest. A 52-year-old Perth man will face court today, charged with possession of child exploitation material following a joint investigation by Western Australian Police and the Australian Federal Police. The man's Mossman Park home was raided earlier this month after he was identified during an investigation into people accessing a child abuse site on the dark web. Officers from WA's Joint Anti-Child Exploitation Team seized a laptop and hard drive, allegedly holding images and videos of disturbing material. He's been charged with two counts of possessing child abuse material and one count of using a carriage service to access child abuse material. You're listening to ABC News.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer warns Donald Trump not to reward Russian aggression as the two leaders meet in Washington. Also, Antoinette Latouf's unlawful termination case against the ABC wraps up, and a fashion parade with a difference, a new range of trousers for people who use colostomy bags.
There's 55,000 of us in Australia. I think there's a growing need for these sorts of clothing solutions. It'd be great if I could end up making a bit of money out of it, but that's not the... I think that's a long way off.
Well, last week, Donald Trump called the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky a dictator. Today, he's told reporters he can't believe he said that and is expecting to have a good meeting with Mr. Zelensky at the White House this weekend. At his meeting with Mr. Trump in Washington today, the UK's Prime Minister Keir Starmer warned that any agreement for long-term peace in Ukraine can't reward Russian aggression. Observers say that despite the diplomatic pleasantries, the UK and Europe should remain very concerned about the Trump administration's pivot towards Russia. Gavin Coote filed this report.
Thank you very much. As he hosted UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer at the White House to discuss the war in Ukraine, US President Donald Trump was talking up the prospects of a long-term peace agreement.
I think we've made a lot of progress, and I think it's moving along pretty rapidly. And we'll let you know what happens. It'll either be fairly soon or it won't be at all.
Sir Keir is the latest in a series of European leaders to come to Washington and push their case. Amid growing concern, both Ukraine and Europe could be sidelined in peace talks between the US and Russia. The British leader applauded President Trump's push to end the war, but warned of the stakes in any agreement.
There's a famous slogan in the United Kingdom from after the Second World War. That is that we have to win the peace. And that's what we must do now, because it can't be peace that rewards the aggressor or that gives encouragement to regimes like Iran. We agree history must be on the side of the peacemaker, not the invader.
The next visitor at the White House, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who will meet with Donald Trump tomorrow morning, Washington time. The pair is expected to thrash out the details of a critical minerals deal, which President Trump is seeking in repayment for US military aid during the war.
And I think we're going to have a very good meeting tomorrow morning. We're going to get along really well, okay? We have a lot of respect. I have a lot of respect for him. We've given him a lot of equipment and a lot of money, but they have fought very bravely, no matter how you figure. They have really fought. Somebody has to use that equipment, and they have been very brave in that sense.
Tensions have been rising between the pair after the US opened diplomatic channels with Russia, prompting a complaint from President Zelensky about being left out. That led President Trump to label Ukraine's president a dictator, comments he now claims he doesn't recall.
Did I say that? I can't believe I said that. Next question.
The critical minerals deal would give the US access to half the revenue generated from Ukraine's natural resources. And President Trump has suggested that the presence of US mining there would act as a deterrent against future Russian attacks. John Herbst, a former US ambassador to Ukraine, thinks such a deal would be in both countries' interests.
We're talking about rare earth and critical minerals, which are vital to a modern economy. China has a stranglehold on rare earth minerals, and they have not been loath to use that, the fact they have this stranglehold, to pressure other countries to do things they want. So the United States needs reliable suppliers of such minerals, and Ukraine would be a reliable supplier. As a transactional president, he understands the value of these minerals, and this gives him an additional very concrete reason to do business with Ukraine, and for that matter, to be concerned about its survival and its economic viability and its security.
Others are more skeptical. Quentin Peel is an associate professor with the Europe program at Chatham House.
And Donald Trump's argument is the Russians wouldn't dare attack them, so they'll be a form of security guarantee. I mean, I think that's for the birds, to be quite honest, partly because I'm not at all sure that these rare earths exist in any significant quantity. I also don't think they could be exploited at any speed, so you really wouldn't get more than maybe just a few dozen people coming in the short term. So in the long term, is this a valid way of saying we'll give you security by putting in a few miners?
And despite the flurry of European-led diplomacy in Washington, Quentin Peel fears the gulf between the US and its allies could further widen.
I think one has to read between the lines of the nice noises that they make about each other. And when Keir Starmer, for example, thanks the US president for changing the conversation on Ukraine, read between the lines, Britain is appalled by the way that the US has been handling the peace talks with Moscow and declaring President Zelensky of Ukraine a dictator. I mean, just extraordinary, turning US policy on its head.
During today's meeting with Keir Starmer, President Trump was also asked about the AUKUS defence alliance between the US, UK and Australia, and seemed unfamiliar with the term, although it's unclear if he simply misheard or misunderstood the British reporter's question.
Gavin Coote. Andrew Tate, the controversial social media influencer who's accused of rape and human trafficking, has arrived in Florida after Romania dropped its travel restrictions on him. The self-described misogynist and his co-accused brother Tristan are vocal supporters of Donald Trump, and there are reports one of the president's envoys raised their case with Romania's foreign minister. Mr. Trump denies claims he was behind the British-American brother's return to the US, but some observers believe there's a link between Trumpism and the rise of so-called toxic masculinity. Catherine Gregory reports.
Andrew Tate has more than 10 million followers on the social media platform X. His so-called manosphere is known as a kind of online academy where he teaches young men how to get rich and attract women.
Disloyalty is the most disgusting thing a female could ever do to her man.
But are you loyal?
Let's not pretend that male loyalty and female loyalty are the same thing.
A controversial figure, the influencer is known for promoting misogynistic views on women.
The woman must learn that her man is f***ing an iron mountain and the easiest path is to obey. Any other kind of resistance simply doesn't work.
Andrew Tate is also facing charges of rape, human trafficking and money laundering in Romania, charges he denies.
We live in a democratic society where it's innocent until proven guilty, and I think my brother and I are largely misunderstood.
He's speaking there in Florida after arriving in the US yesterday with his brother Tristan Tate on a private plane after Romania lifted a travel ban on the pair.
There's a lot of opinions about us, a lot of things that go around about us on the internet. We've yet to be convicted of any crime in our lives ever. We have no criminal record anywhere on the planet ever.
But it's the pair's mysterious arrival in the US that has sparked international outrage and many questions, given Andrew Tate's outspoken support for US President Donald Trump and a reciprocal support from the president's inner circle for the brothers. Their arrival also comes after the Romanian government revealed a US official in the current Trump administration had expressed interest in the brothers' legal case in Romania during a conversation at a security conference in Munich. Donald Trump denies knowledge of this conversation and he denies putting any pressure on Romania.
I mean, Tate has been in Romania now for a number of years under house arrest and there's been no possibility of those travel bans being lifted. The conversation only began once Trump was officially elected.
Dr. Stephanie Westcott is a feminist researcher at Monash University and has studied the popularity of Tate. She believes the Trump administration is behind Romania's decision to lift the travel ban on the Tates.
But also that, you know, Donald Trump has expressed support for Andrew Tate, and he is a fan of, you know, wealthy men with large followings and podcasts, of which, you know, Andrew Tate fits that description.
Dr. Westcott says regardless, the rises of Donald Trump and Andrew Tate have happened simultaneously, each movement influencing and feeding the other. Plus, she believes Andrew Tate has such wide reach online that it's appealing to Donald Trump.
Having millions and millions of views is very powerful, and is something that absolutely Donald Trump would be interested in. We've also seen Donald Trump working with unelected characters who are having a huge influence on the political landscape, such as Elon Musk. So he is clearly very keen to work with, you know, who we would absolutely describe as dangerous bad actors.
Dr. Westcott says Andrew Tate has created a dangerous cult-like following of misogynistic radicalisation among young men, and it's been observed in many parts of the Western world, including in Australia.
We know in multiple regions that young men are becoming more right-leaning, and that they are more likely, of course, than young girls and young women to indicate support for figures like Donald Trump.
The brothers also face charges of sexual aggression in the UK, and Andrew Tate is facing civil action for allegations of rape and coercive control in the UK, all of which they deny. So what happens next for the brothers? Romania's anti-organised crime agency said in a statement that the brothers will still have to appear before judicial authorities there when summoned. But Dr. Ben Rich, a senior lecturer in international relations and history at Curtin University, reckons that won't happen.
I mean, I think it's very unlikely that they will return, even though they've declared that they will. But, I mean, I think the only leverage that the Romanian government will have potentially over them are their assets in that country.
He thinks the Trump administration will try to protect the brothers, given its propensity to pack its base with conservative digital influences. But some conservatives, including the Republican governor of Florida, have pushed back against the arrival of the Tates in the US. Still, as Dr. Rich points out, Donald Trump has a new brand of right-wing conservative politics that fits with Andrew Tate's ideology too.
He doesn't seem to be constrained at all by the sort of pretense of the historical far right, and is much more willing to flaunt things like the rule of law, like sort of social norms. And I think someone like Tate is also very, very much in that camp. So there is a natural kind of harmony between the two.
That's Dr. Ben Rich from Curtin Uni. Catherine Gregory with that report. Lawyers for the ABC have told the federal court that senior managers took freelance journalist Antoinette Latouf off air because she shared a post about the war in Gaza after being instructed not to. Ms. Latouf has taken the ABC to court, arguing she was unlawfully terminated a few days into a five-day stint as a presenter on Sydney Radio in 2023. In its closing arguments on the last day of the case, the national broadcaster told the court if damages are awarded to Ms. Latouf, they should only be a modest sum. Our reporter David Estcourt has been following the case. David, why does the ABC argue it was entitled to take Antoinette Latouf off air before her contract ended?
Well, essentially, Sam, they say that she was given a direction not to post anything about the war in Gaza, which she did on Instagram. So they responded by telling her that she wasn't needed for Thursday and Friday. That's the ABC's argument. And today, the ABC's lawyer, Ian Neal, argued that it wasn't political opinions which saw Antoinette Latouf taken off air. It was because she, quote, did something that she was told not to do, which was post about the war in Gaza. So when they were asked by Justice Daryl Rangia what she was told not to do, Neal said, quote, she was told, in effect, not to post anything in relation to the conflict in Israel and Gaza during the week she was with the ABC. So the ABC argues it was sharing the content on social media, which meant she had breached this directive from senior staff. Now, Ms. Latouf rejects that, saying that she wasn't given this direction at all.
And what other issues did the ABC's lawyers raise in their closing submissions?
The ABC's legal team did admit that taking her off air caused her some distress, and they also said that the action of taking her off air wasn't punishment. Instead, it was designed to protect the ABC. Now, Mr. Neil also talked about this concept of journalists and presenters at the ABC needing to remain impartial. This concept of impartiality applies to editorial staff at the ABC. It's a statutory obligation. That is to be impartial, but also to be seen to be impartial by the public. And the ABC argued that employees must conduct themselves in a way where that impartiality and that perception of impartiality is not jeopardised. This is where Ms. Ledoux's conduct came into question. Mr. Neil said this concept is of central importance to the ABC. He also argued that this obligation to remain impartial applies to conduct outside of work, meaning, according to the ABC's legal team at least, the social media posts can threaten or undermine this impartiality. So applying that to Ms. Latouf's case, this is one of the reasons, according to the ABC lawyers, that there were concerns about her posting in this manner about the war, that she might jeopardise this idea that reporters and hosts must be seen to be impartial.
Now, the former chair of the ABC board, Ita Buttrose, told the court that she regarded Ms. Latouf as an activist. Has that issue of activism been raised by the ABC in its closing arguments?
It was raised this afternoon, Sam. Mr. Neil argued that there is nothing wrong with being an activist at the ABC, but the problem arises when an employee begins sharing those opinions because it might call into question this idea of impartiality that we just discussed. That idea is that if she is perceived as biased, there might be a breach of the ABC's statutory obligation to remain impartial. Mr. Neil also argued that Antoinette Latouf's legal team were unable to point to evidence that Ms. Latouf's race bore in any way on the decision to remove her from air, which was quite a contentious point in the case.
So the case is finished. The closing arguments have been heard. What happens now?
Well, Sam, that's at least it for the hearings. All that's left is for Federal Court Justice Darryl Rangia to consider the case of both sides and deliver his decision at a later date. But at this stage, there's no indication of when he'll hand that decision down.
David Escort reporting for us there. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a new range of trousers for people with colostomy bags shown off at the Melbourne Fashion Festival. When domestic violence is discussed in the media, the focus is often on how to best support victims. But some of those working in the field are calling on governments to broaden their focus to look at changing the behaviour of perpetrators, something a West Australian program is doing with some success. Kian Burke has more.
When Lucy was granted a family violence restraining order against her abusive ex-partner, she thought it was the end of a long and emotionally draining process. We've changed her name to protect her identity.
Initially, there was this moment of relief. I thought that I would finally feel safe and that I could move on. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
She says her partner was charged with breaching the order 18 times over 10 months, ranging from messaging her on social media to waiting for her in public car parks.
It was like he got in a cycle of really bad behaviour and didn't know how to get out of it. And had he had support, maybe that wouldn't have happened.
Lucy now works for the peak body Community Legal WA. One of their members, Sussex Street Community Law Centre, is trying to provide that support to perpetrators.
Most of the respondents that we assist don't actually understand the restraining order process and don't actually understand that family violence is not always about the physical elements.
That's Michael, one of the lawyers who provides over-the-phone advice as well as free representation in mediation and court hearings.
And so my role as a lawyer is about advising them on the options, but also getting them to have a little bit more understanding of the process and maybe perhaps insight into their behaviour.
According to the centre, all of that work makes a big difference, but it's legal representation in shuttle conferencing which often has the biggest impact. That's a program more than half of contested family violence restraining orders go through in the Perth Magistrates Court, usually the less serious ones. On the day, a registrar shuttles between each side, who are in different rooms, to negotiate an agreement. Sussex Street's principal solicitor, Johanna Wanaden, says of the cases which go through shuttle conferencing, more than 70% are resolved without going to trial.
Of that 70%, we have a breach rate of 1 to 2%.
That's compared to 15% for cases which don't go through the conferencing process. The success, she says, comes from getting both sides to the table.
Having a respondent buy into their own settlement means that there naturally is a lower rate of breach, because instead of feeling like it's something that's forced on them by a court, there is ownership of the participation in the process.
It's programs like these Damien Green wants to see state and federal governments investing more in. He's the head of Stopping Family Violence, the peak body for perpetrator-focused services in WA. He says change will only come from answering one question.
How do we respond to the cause of harm rather than respond to just the symptoms of that harm and those that are being impacted by it? In order to do that work well, we've got to really shift our focus over to who is causing this harm in the community.
Damien Green says there needs to be a wide variety of those responses in addition to supporting victim survivors.
It's sort of incumbent on us to do both, make sure that those impacted right now are supported, but also that we're doing something with the perpetrator to stop them from, or hopefully stop them from, using violence into the future, whether that's with their current partner or future families.
Damien Green from the Stopping Family Violence Program in WA. Kian Burke reporting there. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, call 000. Tens of thousands of Australians live with stoma pouches, also known as colostomy bags. They're small, waterproof satchels that collect faeces and urine. Melbourne man Henry Dalgleish had his stoma bag attached after surgery to treat a severe case of Crohn's disease. And he soon realised that none of the pants he used to wear fitted anymore. So he set about creating a new line of trousers for people in his situation. Our reporter Oliver Gordon went to the launch of the new venture and saw the garments make their debut on the runway at the Melbourne Fashion Festival.
Models, loud music, frantic outfit changes and champagne flutes. This feels like any other Melbourne fashion event. But for budding fashion designer Henry Dalgleish, it's something much more.
It was a bit emotional. I actually teared up a little bit seeing something that means so much to me kind of make it onto the runway.
34-year-old Henry Dalgleish never imagined he'd be here, watching models catwalk a pair of pants he'd invented. His journey into the world of clothing design was very unconventional. It started about 5 years ago, when he first experienced symptoms of what would eventually be diagnosed as Crohn's disease, a type of inflammatory bowel disease.
I was actually in Lebanon in 2019, 2020, when I first experienced the symptoms, which were kind of pretty acute stomach pain and bleeding from the rectum.
This persisted for a couple of months until he took an urgent flight back home to Melbourne.
2 days later, I was in emergency, and I think 5 days after that, I was having surgery to remove the colon in its entirety, and as a result, yeah, I've had a stoma since 2020.
A stoma is an opening in the stomach that's used to remove body waste like faeces or urine. Henry's stoma allows his body to get rid of its waste into a small bag.
For me, it goes into a colostomy bag on my right side. I mean, it's ultimately saved my life because I definitely wouldn't be here without it. But it means there's a bit of, probably a bit of body image issues, but also like discomfort in a lot of clothes that I wear, particularly pants.
After looking unsuccessfully for stoma-friendly men's pants, he grew increasingly frustrated. Then he took action.
I kind of thought, if it doesn't exist, I'll try and create it.
What followed was a long process, collaborating with the design team, including Annalise Bridgman from studio Creation Collective Co.
I guess design is just problem solving. So I guess we just had to listen to each other, and I asked Henry a lot of questions so we could get to the answers that we need.
They came up with two designs, a chino and a formal pant. Both have an internal mechanism that can loosen or tighten as someone's stoma pouch becomes more full or is emptied. The material inside the pants is also spill-friendly.
Fabrics that absorb moisture, so we use them in apparel rather than in activewear.
And importantly, Henry Dalgleish says the way the pants are designed cleverly disguises the pouch.
So it's a bit of a visual trick, so you can't actually see the bag.
Despite being tailored for people with stomas, the pants appear as conventional high-waisted trousers. But he says the focus of the business is on those living with stomas.
There's 55,000 of us in Australia. There's millions worldwide. I think there's a growing need for these sorts of clothing solutions. It'd be great if I could end up making a bit of money out of it, but that's not the... I think that's a long way off.
Now that his pants are getting a run on the catwalk, Henry Dalgleish is glad to have reached this milestone and hopes it inspires others to create clothes that meet their needs.
You never know what you're able to achieve until you put your head, you know, and heart into it and really go 100%. Here we are.
If I had told you 10 years ago that you'd be sitting at a Melbourne fashion event with a new line of pants, would you have believed me?
No, absolutely not. Not in my wildest dreams. I suppose that's kind of the silver lining of getting the illness. It's, for me, it's been like an exercise in trying to use it positively and channel some of that energy into something really positive and probably a little bit bigger than me, yeah.
Melburnian Henry Dalgleish there, Oliver Gordon with that report. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by David Sargent and Joram Toth. I'm Samantha Donovan. PM will be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Radio National.
Welcome to Medialand, your weekly look at what's happening behind the scenes and on your screens. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Dani Saeed, filling in for Vivian Kelly.
Dani, the media story everywhere this week. Triple M's Drive presenter, Marty Shergold. He lost his job on Wednesday night after some bad jokes about women's sport and some even worse ones about women's health. We'll talk to one of his old colleagues about where radio networks draw the line.
And Jeff Bezos says the quiet part out loud and makes a big change to the Washington Post's opinion pages.
First, Dani, one of the political stories of this week is a 15-years-old story. Questions about the timing of opposition leader Peter Dutton's purchases of shares in the big banks in the day or so before Labour announced their 2009 bailout during the global financial crisis. Almost as intriguing as the news.com.au story is the question of how it suddenly made it back into the headlines. Mr. Dutton has a theory.
The Prime Minister's office